gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 286 for the week of Wednesday, January 29th, 2020. That is the day that in 2020, Dave and I did the podcast by ourselves. Hey, Dave.
It's a solo. It's a duo podcast once again, but it's not two guys this time.
That is maybe the strength of doing this podcast for this long with this many people is that like you'd lose two members. You're like, it's fine. This combination will work.
I was telling Java, like, but I'm The Rock, and she's like, did you just self-designate? Which apparently I can't. So even though I'm here all the time, I'm not actually The Rock. I'm just present.
Oh, I thought you were calling yourself, like, The Rock as in, like, Dwayne Johnson in, like, our combo of people, and that made me Kevin Hart? I haven't seen Jumanji.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, sure. That works fine. That seems like it would work.
Did you see Jumanji?
I saw the original film Jumanji, if that's what you mean, but no, I did not see Tumanji or Threemanji.
The first one was Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle, or is that the latest one?
No, I think it's Welcome to the Jungle and like the next level.
Right. I have seen either Jumanji, so I guess I can't be Kevin Hart.
I mean, I think whether or not you're Kevin Hart is really in your heart.
It's a personal decision.
It's something you find your way to. It's something we find our wisdom at the elder tree. And they're like, you, my daughter, are Kevin Hart.
And you wrap your tail braid around Kevin Hart's tail braid, and then you unite at last.
Mm-hmm. Magical Kevin Hart fucking.
Oh, I can't wait for the Avatar movies to come out. That's a whole other segment we'll have to do when Patches and David are back, but...
Yeah, we beat Patches in terms of I just talked about maybe having Avatar sex with Kevin Hart, or you did, or we both did, or we all are, and we haven't even gotten to the topic
yet. And here
yet.
I was being like, this is going to be a structured episode. I'm not Matt Patches. I'm not just going to go off on weird tangents and ask uncomfortable questions. But I don't know. Having two less people really inspires that in us, doesn't it?
Well, like Patches said that ostensibly his most recent episode he did with me was about the Golden Globes. Right. You actually did give us a topic that we prepared for to structure this episode a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this was, I don't know. I feel like many of our most successful episodes are everybody watched a movie. Often that's Quarter Quells. And then every now and then, I feel like we've done it for, you know, like Star Wars or actually I haven't seen Star Wars for a Marvel movie, whatever. When we've all seen the movie, it becomes interesting. And I last week I had a couple nights by myself because my husband was out of town. So I was kind of like doing deep Netflix dives, both on like, the Brazilian documentary Edge of Democracy, which is nominated for an Oscar and is very good, but somber and not really a fun podcast topic. And then I was just trying to think of things that I hadn't seen that were maybe very easy to find that I could cross off the list. So I suggested to you that we do a segment where we each picked a movie that we hadn't seen that was available for streaming and made the other person talk about it. I chose The Bling Ring because the way that I wound up on The Bling Ring is that Nancy Jo Sayles, who wrote the article that The Bling Ring is based on for Vanity Fair, wrote kind of like a 10-year anniversary thing about just like what her life has been like, which is basically being harassed endlessly by Alexis Nyers, who is the real person who the Emma Watson character was based on. We'll talk about that more about her later. But she just wrote a piece for us about that, and the peg being that The Bling Ring was on Netflix. So it kind of came up to me. I don't know. Have you spent any time like looking through Netflix trying to find a movie, like not a Netflix original movie, but like any old movie? I mean, maybe you did this to make your pick.
I actually did recently because I had finished the Karina Longworth book, Seduction, Howard Hughes's Hollywood, recently after, you know, starting it and then waiting until I had like a holiday to actually finished it and had like a list of like old movies that I wanted to see either parts of or in their entirety. And I thought there's absolutely no way any of these are on Netflix. So I started to just try to find the oldest movies on Netflix I could find. Their classics heading is mostly things released since I've been alive. and that I was able to find most of the Karina Longworth referenced Howard Hughes movies on YouTube in their entirety. But that did
because
mean...
they're all when the copyrights expired.
Correct.
Right now, yeah.
So I did spend some time in Netflix going through what I considered their oldest movies, and like even a lot of like the black and white movies that I could have sworn were there have been wiped.
Oh yeah,
in the years
I watched
since
the African
looked.
Queen on Netflix a couple years ago, and I'm certain that's not on there anymore.
Yeah. So in terms of their classic selection. I didn't have a lot of luck, but I did find one comedy from the 80s that I hadn't seen, and so I put it on my list. And so when you were like, hey, pick a movie, I was like, how about something on my list? And I scrolled on over, and I'm gonna bring Stripes to the table. So it's gonna be interesting to see if we can connect these two movies, I think, because they're they can have, I mean, it's sort of like a view of privilege from both sides, maybe.
They're very
I don't
much
know.
Of their times, like they are both time capsules of the periods in which they were made for really different reasons. And obviously the Bling Ring is more recent, so it's a little bit more accessible.
Yeah, and the Bling Ring was nice because it has a lot of the music that I was still banging to when I was still keeping up with the normal everyday music.
And
then actually
never,
a lot of celebrity culture stuff.
You'd never seen The Bling Ring either, right?
I had seen I saw it when it came out, but this was my second time seeing it. And it is nice to sort of see it outside of the rush of it being released and of people being like, oh my God, Hermione can act and is hot now, which dominated a lot of the conversation when it came out, which both of those things are true.
Yep.
But they didn't have to be contextualized in Hermione, as we learned now from Emma Watson, Disney princess. So it's nice to go back and sort of watch it, not only because it's like surprisingly non-moralizing, and it is like a comedy, or it is like a crime satire more than like a crime comedy, in the sense that the things that are funny about it are also like presented as absolute truths of these characters.
Like what?
Like everything. I think the movie starts off with like the Emma Watson speech where she's like, for all I want to know, I want to run a country someday.
And I think that that's an actual Alexis Nyers quote, if I'm remembering correctly from the Nancy Joseph piece.
Yes. Or then later on when she's like, I want to rob, or then, really any of the main teen cast's characters, of who I can only remember Tessa Farmiga as the actors' names now. But they say things, and as a adult who's watching a movie, you're like, well, that's dumb, or like they're playing with a gun or whatever. But also each one of those moments and each one of the times we're in the club and the music's bumping and it's like suddenly the music fades out, we're in this like magical space.
Mm-hmm.
I'm laughing at them, but also I completely understand why dumb kids living in that culture were caught up in the whole Bling Ring scandal, and
yeah.
Kind of surprised that, you know, not more of them were able to turn it around into like some more forward facing celebrity like the Nikki character does in the movie. And it sounds like the real life basis for her has been trying to do to poor Mary Jo Sayles for 10 years.
Well, yeah, because they were adjacent to like the World of the Hills, which is kind of like what I can't remember who's the first house. I guess Paris Hilton's the first house they go to. But, you know, Audrina Patridge is one of the houses that they rob. Like they are in this world in which people become famous for basically being exactly who they are. And you can imagine them being like, well, but I'm like beautiful and young and I live in Los Angeles. Like, why shouldn't I be famous for all of this? Which is kind of how they wind up like breaking into their houses too. Cause they're like, here's a life that I want. I'm going to like literally open a door and walk into this house and take all the things from this life that I want. And, they feel so entitled to it. So the thing that I like can't wrap my head around, and I'm sure this is something that came up when people were writing about the film when it came out, and it's just been long enough that I don't remember it that well. Is that you talk about her not really moralizing, like the stuff that's funny is not really laughing at the characters. It's like really seeing from their point of view, which I think is what, you know, you've seen Marie Antoinette, you've seen Virgin Suicides, you like would expect Sofia Coppola to do that. But it also feels like removed from them in a way that made me want, like, I wanted a sense of like the actual relationship between any of them. I wanted to like feel bad when I think the ringleader is the ringleader named Katie. No, Rebecca, her actress is named Katie. Like Rebecca and Mark have this like really intense friendship, and she, you know, talks about how she'll never betray him, and of course eventually she does. I didn't feel that at all. Like I didn't feel anything for any of them. I was fascinated by them. I felt empathetic to them, but like I was thinking about the moments in The Social Network, a movie that we talked about a little while ago, when Mark and Eduardo's friendship falls apart, you really feel for them. And there wasn't any of that emotion in here. And I don't think it was going for it, but I wondered if that would have helped the movie at all, if I'd kind of had a sense of there being a tragedy in this more than just like a metaphor for, you know, insert whatever you want to say about American culture.
Yeah, I wonder if also if you got too close to them, if you would end up hating them.
Oh,
like, if that
definitely.
Distance... Yeah, the distance is there so it could be an enjoyable watch at some point, because at some point you're just going to hate Rebecca or what's-her-face for just being like, well, look up this person's address, and just like stringing Mark along into like crime. Mm-hmm. And like, obviously he makes the choice to do it, and they all do, and that's why they all, most of them get punished. But it's, I think if you get, if you have the Hustlers ending, in this, then
I didn't think of it as the Hustlers ending, but that's a great example.
Then I think the front half of the movie isn't laying the groundwork for that. I think it would feel weird and out of place at that point.
Because
the movie sinks into, oh my God, we're like high criminals, like really fast. It's like, it seems like they're breaking into some houses, and then there's that one amazing break into someone's house.
Audrina's house.
Audrina's house. This one shot.
Like, what is it? Push in, like from a far distance.
And you've sort of like, not only are you actually distant from them, so you can't see like some of the more humanizing things, like, oh my God, like this bag is this, and like this is this.
But you've also seen that a million times, so you kind of can imagine it for yourself, even though.
Yeah, and now they've made it a we need money thing, and then the next one is they sell Orlando Bloom's watches, and they're straight up like fencing something, and that like. Rolls over to he brings stolen material across state lines. And so it's like all these little things. And I think if we were closer to them, maybe that would make us understand why they were making these dumb choices. But I think it also would have made us really, really dislike a lot of them, if not all of them, like straight out.
Yeah. So I think you're already kind of do dislike all of them, but also, like you were saying before, like you relate to it just enough to kind of want to see what happens next.
Yeah, I think that's the part about the why it feels like it doesn't have a strong morality to me is we don't spend a lot of time outside of the world. Mm-hmm. So our victims are still Paris Hilton, regardless of, you know, what we're seeing on the screen. And our victims are still, you know, Megan Fox and Rachel Bilson. And like these people are having their privacy violated, but we are also seeing the excess that they're portrayed as having in this movie as a way of like, Paris Hilton is of course not going to miss all the stuff they take from her, because she has rooms full of everything, a different room for shoes, a different room for jewelry. And so even though they should get caught because what they're doing is wrong, the film is really good at playing with that balance where it's like fun, it's fun to watch them be bad for the most part. And it's not, there are a couple of moments early on where the movie really like amps up the crime tension. And it's sort of seeping in at the sides before the CCTV footage, where it's like sometimes the score will have like ominous thumps or keep the party like a little bit distant from you. It's really it's a nice movie that bobs in and out of their headspace, I think, without, you're right in the sense that you're not really anchored to a particular character's story because nobody's far enough away from wealth, I don't think, for me to really care about them.
Yeah. I mean, I was reading David's Letterboxd review of this because I know, like, David loves Sofia Coppola, and I figured that he had written something about it. He wrote about it on Letterboxd, which I don't know where he was working when this movie came out, but kind of he was pointing out about how the story kind of moves between all the different characters. Like it doesn't really stick with any one of them. He says the film doesn't presume to know the chemistry behind the immediate connection, talking about Rebecca and the boy. What's his name? What's the Mark?
I think Mark's the character. Yeah.
But it just kind of like it kind of like steps away from them. And it's hard to think of a director other than Sofia Coppola who could have done that kind of like clinical, like, I'm going to have a distance from these characters, but not feel judgmental of them. And I think that is something that you really appreciate. And it's hard to even put your finger on what it is that she can do other than, like, aside from the fact that, you know, she's, like, made movies about, like, rich girls before and, like, has her own Hollywood background. It does feel, like you were saying, like a world without morality, partly because this is a victimless crime and partly because it's interesting. Like, it's not really interesting that, like, they did a wrong thing. Everyone knows they did, but, like, why they did it and how they did it. Like, that's what makes the story worth telling. And you don't want to, like, slap people on the wrist for being interested in these people, because obviously everyone is. So it's, you want to, like, let the story unfold kind of on their terms.
Yeah. It's a weird, I'm having trouble actually pinpointing in the movie at what point. I think it's probably like the second house that Rebecca and Mark break into. It's like not, no. I think maybe it's the first house where it's like somebody's just in Jamaica and he's like, we need to get out of here. And she's like, oh, this house is really nice.
Is that the house the car that they take?
Yes. That feels, the car taking is probably where it feels like a line's crossed.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about this movie is Rebecca's so good at, eking us into the crime, where it's like at first we're just opening car doors, mm-hmm. and taking whatever is in the door, and then it's, why wouldn't you want to see where Paris Hilton lives?
Yeah.
Like, she keeps the key under the mat, and like before you know it, you're fencing Orlando Bloom's watches, which, fine.
Have you ever had someone just open your car door and take something out of it, like, or like rifle through your car because you forgot to lock it?
No, thankfully I have this it predated my smartphone days, but now when I like go through a doorway, I touch like my smartphone, my wallet, and my keys. I had the same sort of thing where habitually when I'm walking away from my car, I'm clicking the lock button just like all the time.
Yeah, that's a common in my neighborhood, which is like pretty safe. Like, that's a pretty common crime that happens. A lot of people will be like, yeah, someone rifled through my car and didn't take anything. Anyway, you just think about, like, if you're a teenager who's like bored and doesn't really care that much about morality, like, it's such an easy thing to do.
Yeah. And it's probably low stakes if you get caught, if you're just like a teenager in an affluent neighborhood. Like,
oh, yeah.
With a car door open.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing is like I feel like the movie gets at some of this is the way the cops arrive at their houses. Like, Mark, who's a little bit poor, like the cops kind of knock down his door, and at the house of, the Emma Watson character who's like lives with her rich mom. They like knock very politely and like try to get past the dogs. And like, there's like a little bit of class commentary, even in a movie that's basically all about rich people.
Yeah. And it's not, I don't know. Maybe it is distant enough. Like, this is also an interesting movie because I came up blogging and like gossip blogging. So I know the mindset of these people by like having to put it on and wear it every once in a while. So like scrolling through D-listed and like Lindsay Lohan got like another DUI. Like, those were the stories I remember working.
I remember so those days.
Yeah. Like, was it me? Like, definitely the scene where like Mark's listening to music and smoking pot and trying on expensive scarves. I've done that just without the scarves. So
scarves. Don't knock yourself.
I have an expensive scarf.
You know what? You live in Colorado. I'm glad you have an expensive scarf.
But like, so maybe Mark is far enough out. Maybe there's just a missing moment for me to really see him as me and fully empathize with him. He definitely does come off as empathetic, but I think that's also because it was him and the Emma Watson character in real life who made the basis for the magazine story, right?
I think so. And he's also like positioned as the like window into this world, which is a classic way for a story to be told, being like, hey, here's the new kid. Like, Harry Potter is like that as one of many examples. But I think I do like that it's not trying to be like, and he is the hero in the end, and he's the one who was really led astray, because like, he is as susceptible to all of the bullshit of this as anybody else.
Yeah, he Googles every address they ask him to Google, even though they could Google it.
Well, that's the other thing that's funny, is like, the hook of the original Vanity Fair article was like, they use social media to tell where the stars were going to be and commit their crimes, which is now just like such an easy thing to do, and I imagine is like pretty anodyne if you're trying to break into somebody's house. Not that I
remember
it.
People telling me not to use Foursquare back in the day for that reason. They're like, because then they'll know you're gone, it'll break into your house. And I'm like, I have roommates,
they're all
live in
home.
Brooklyn. Yeah, If they want to go to my Brooklyn apartment and fight my roommates, they are welcome to do that at any time.
Isn't it weird to think that, like, there used to be a whole app just to tell people, like, the entire purpose of the app was to tell other people where you were?
Yeah, it does seem weird now. That was very also pre, like, opening my eyes to the horrible male toxicity of the world. So now it really seems like a bad idea.
Oh, like, in terms of like how like male stalkers are like.
Well, people are like, oh, that's a stalker tool. And I was like, no, I just want to tell people where they could meet me for beer. And now I'm like, oh, no, that was totally a stalker tool.
Yeah. I mean, but like Instagram has kind of, you know, consumed a lot of that. So I imagine that's still happening, even if Foursquare isn't a factor. Foursquare must have gotten bought by like Facebook or somebody.
Oh yeah, and I'm sure like yeah, because Facebook has like that check-in mechanic, which I also don't use because it's weird.
Declare yourself safe in some emergency that happened.
Maybe I would use that if there was like a huge emergency in Colorado, just because Facebook's still like tethering me to a certain generation of people who weren't there when I started being on Facebook and weren't there in the middle, but are definitely now all there that I'm gone off Facebook.
Are you thinking about like parents or like the
parents, uncles, like people from high school that like took a long time to get on social media or whatever? There's always people like, oh, hey, like you have 76 new friend requests. I'm like, oh, 76? I'm not on friend. It is not good.
Yeah. No, I don't post on Facebook, but I put Instagram things on there. And then when like one of my great aunts will comment on something, I'm like, all right, I'm not leaving. You've got me for now. Because they're not on Instagram. I'm like, I'm not. I mean, also Instagram's on my Facebook. I don't know what kind of moral stance I'm pretending to take here.
One of the things I like about the Bling Ring time period specifically is they're taking selfies without front-facing cameras, which... That's going to be a very specific time period in selfie technology.
Yeah.
We used to have to know our angles without knowing the actual angle we were looking at.
And that was, they're going on their computer and uploading the photos onto Facebook the next day. There's like a whole like thing where you're like clicking select on the image files to put onto Facebook, which is fascinating.
You can't just do it directly from whatever device you have on you.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they had smartphones, but you wouldn't be able to like upload a photo as effectively. I'm trying to remember like the timeline because the article was published in 2010. I mean, I guess this, like they don't have iPhones, so I guess this was before all of that.
Well, I mean, there's in terms of like the front-facing cameras, that's like a 2012, 2013.
Yeah, I don't think the original iPhone definitely didn't have a front-facing camera.
Yeah, and also original cell phone cameras were horrible.
Yeah.
Listen up, kids. Oh, I'm already saying listen up, kids, about the Bling Ring. Good. That's horrible.
No, I mean, there's definitely some like fascinating technology. It's just the whole like that they had to go to a party to brag to their, you know, classmates about what they were doing at these famous people's houses rather than like having it on a, you know, Instagram group or whatever. And also like we don't know what the teens are up to these days. So who are we to say?
That's right. Where's the TikTok, the criminal TikToks that I'm not seeing?
Oh, there's going to be so many, obviously. I mean, I might have said this on the show before, but I have like a 13-year-old cousin who I follow on Instagram, and she posts a ton on Instagram, and I'm always just like, yeah, but this is the Instagram that she like lets me see. Like, she has a whole other Instagram with so much more on there that I'm not even getting a look at, and it's overwhelming.
Do you think they're saving it?
Like, the stuff that they put on Instagram?
Like, one of the nice things about being, I don't know, the time of internet that I was, is I hosted my own blog during, like, college, and then Facebook came along, and just everything went up on Facebook, and then Facebook got gross, and so I pulled everything I could, and I didn't delete it, but I saved it. I backed up my Facebook files, because I realized they only kind of exist there, but I'm wondering if people are, like, multi-apping and shadow profiling. Is there any point in keeping your interactions?
Probably not. I mean, I imagine people aren't saving it. Like, I had a live journal for several years that I have never backed up in any real way, and I probably should. And same with tweets, although I'm less worried about, like, all of my tweets disappearing. Have you had your journalistic work disappear because, like, a site went under?
I have a lot of stuff where it's hard to find, from like Latino Review becoming Latino-Review and whatever it is now.
I didn't even think about the hyphen.
Yeah, that screwed up a whole bunch of my stuff. But yeah, really early on, I started keeping drafts of things. But in terms of like finished stuff, like the New York Times vertical I did for The Last Jedi was like really prettily designed and maybe is still up there, but I'm sad I didn't like just download that entire website.
I bet that's there somewhere.
Gotta find it. Find it and keep it for myself.
I got an email from my first job out of college was at Film Journal International, which is, it's a trade publication for movie theater owners. It was a great job. I was really happy to have it. And I got an email from the editor there who was, sent an email to all the former writers who was like, you click on your byline, search for any piece that you wrote there. You get a chronological collection of all your writings. Unfortunately, we never solved the problem of the 5-year gap, fall 2008 to 2013, where the bylines went missing. So if you had, I actually had gone by that point, so I shouldn't have anything lost, but it's just interesting that like it's there, but like unless you're in that weird computer glitch, it's gone.
Unless you're in the gap years. Oh.
Should we talk about Stripes?
Let's talk about Stripes. So I Wikipedia'd Stripes because I knew nothing about Stripes really outside of I knew it was a Ivan Reitman comedy, and I knew it was one of those Bill Murray comedies that like made Bill Murray, like post Bill Murray. Stripes was Bill Murray movie star, not Bill Murray Saturday Night Live star. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, I like Bill Murray movies, ostensibly. But apparently I've not seen Stripes. So, I Wikipedia'd it, and the first sentence, the first two sentence, test sentences of the production entry on the Wikipedia page is, on his way to the premiere of Meatballs, Ivan Reitman thought up the idea for a film. Cheech and Chong joined the army. He pitched it to Paramount Pictures, and they greenlit the film that day. So as a Latinx person, do I get to say that this has been taken from my culture?
Yes. I think good. Basically everyone gets to have a complaint about Stripes in some way. So you put in your entry, and I'll put in mine, and we'll take okay. Stripes down for good.
Yeah, if we get one, then let me save it for later, because this movie's weird. I mean... I guess they don't make them like they used to type of movies, because Stripes, super popular in the 80s comedy oeuvre. And,
it's got an incredible collection of stars. Like,
yeah, you got Judge Reinhold, you've got like,
John Candy, role, and then Harold Ramis and Bill Murray.
Harold Ramis, obviously. Yes. And then some okay backup players, doing their
Sean
armiest.
Young before Blade Runner.
Yes. Sean Young playing an MP with, motivations that don't make any sense to me, but that's fine.
John Larroquette is in one of his first roles.
It's a movie about Bill Murray's character, who is kind of like a loser. He's just sarcastic all the time, can't hold down a job, lives with his girlfriend or something.
His girlfriend, who we see in her first entry on screen. What's she doing?
Showering?
Topless.
No, she's definitely topless.
Sorry, that's what I was going for. Boobs. She is showing her boobs in her very first scene.
Oh yeah, this is a bit, there's a period of 80s movies where if you're making a comedy and you want it to be a comedy for, you know, the National Lampoon crowd, in this case, probably literally, then you put a lot of boobs in it. It's the Animal House, Stripes way. Stop for some boobs. There's an entire sequence in the middle of this movie where they leave the base after their sergeant is blown up. He lives, don't worry, it's a comedy still. they go to a club, and John Candy mud wrestles like five women, and the triumphant score soaring moment of this like 10 minute sequence is John Candy pulls off like five bras. He says, like for Delta Company. And then the score swells and the police come in, and that's the end of the, you know, that's the climax of the sequence.
And they're so excited.
Yeah,
I told my husband, who I watched some of this with me, which is funny because he watches so few movies with me, and he kept walking in and out being like, this movie sucks. But I was like, okay, John Candy and like mud wrestling a bunch of women, like this could be funny. Like, I don't know that I think of John Candy for doing physical comedy, so like I didn't have like a strong reason for it, but like I saw them setting it up and I was like, I'm ready. And then it just sucks. Like the, it all just like sits there. And you know that there was a context for it in the 80s that was a little bit different, but it still just feels like they just didn't try.
I mean, I'm reading more down this production thing. Here's another just straight quote from the Wikipedia page. Every scene had some element of improvisation due in large part to Murray and Ramis. Much of the mud wrestling scene was made up on the spot by Reitman. Candy felt uncomfortable during filming, but Reitman talked him through it.
Ugh.
So, like, that sort of seems like that's what this movie is, where you have a premise, which is guy to get out of responsibility, thinks that the army will teach him said responsibility, and he's a sarcastic asshole, and he brings his friend, Harold Ramis, another sarcastic asshole, but one who kind of has a heart of gold.
Harold Ramis is definitely, and I feel like this happens in Ghostbusters 2, which, like, and Ghostbusters the movie as well, not Ghostbusters 2, where Harold Ramis is like, he's also sarcastic, but he's somehow nicer than Bill Murray. Like, that was his whole thing.
Yeah, there's like a smile that's on his face where you know his character knows he's making a joke. Well, Bill Murray will like kind of deadpan it. And it's like, is this guy beat? Like, I still don't know by the end of the movie. Like, is he just like an asshole or is he dumb? Like, at
Ooh,
what?
That's a good question.
The stakes of this movie are so weird because the climactic sequence is they are, after overcoming insurmountable odds of their sergeant being blown up and sleeping through the beginning of their graduation, they get assigned to guard a urban assault vehicle that looks like a camper, which is a funny joke.
Didn't it make you think of the Winnebago? That's the not Starship Enterprise, the Millennium Falcon in Meep. Oh my God, Spaceballs! Jesus Christ, yes.
Not just because John Candy was there.
Not just
and so they're guarding this thing, and they decide to take it on a joyride to impress their MP friends who are in Germany. Yeah, and then their team gets sent by an inept captain or something to go, retrieve them. And the inept captain sends them into Czechoslovakia. So Murray and Ramis have to use the urban assault vehicle to drive into Czechoslovakia and shoot up the place and rescue the prisoners and drive out. And they're helped by their two MP girlfriends.
Which at least answered the question for me of why their girlfriends were in the military. I was like, okay, so there's some reason.
That's the thing. The last third of this movie is like, oh, so this is what the other two thirds of the movie were about. We had to get to this dumb thing, which is the basis of your entire idea, which is what if we took like a family camper and put missiles on it and then used that to blow up a Czechoslovakian base.
Yeah, and it's kind of what you think the movie's going to be when you first get into it, right? But you're like, okay, like, dumb people at war, that's fine. Like, I don't think you need 90 minutes of basic training comedy to get to that, to explain how...
Especially if you're not going to, when they actually get to the Cold War part, not up the stakes at all. I'm not worried about anybody ever. I'm not worried about them blowing up the sergeant. None of this movie takes place in the real world. Everybody wants to show their boobs. Everyone is just waiting for the right sarcastic comment to go from unattractive to the most attractive person on the military base. I just feel like it's like this type of movie that set up young men like me to think there was this type of world out there in any sort of way, which is kind of why I don't like it. Mm. Like, I would rather Cheech and Chong go to the army because, A, pot... Which they, when Judge Reinhold is like, I'm going to sneak in some pot. I'm like, fuck yeah, Judge Reinhold pot in the army. Like, let's do this. Goes nowhere. I'm sad. And the second thing is the, at one point, like, what, two of the black soldiers are like, they would have hung us. And I'm like, oh, this movie does acknowledge that there's a whole bunch of white guys fucking up. But just that once.
Well, there's also the part where Bill Murray's like, hey, black guys, help the white guys with ribbon. And the black guys are like, excuse me. And I don't know. It may, like, that's my, like, maybe raised on the 80s sense of humor where I was like, that's a funny joke, but it's at least, like, somewhat not.
Yeah. Well, and then there's that weird part where John Candy gets up in the black guy's face for something. And I'm like, that's not again, like, John Candy's a lovable bear. He's not going to get up in some black guy's face for something. Anyway, there's bits and pieces of it where if you did Cheech and Chong go to the army, I feel like he could skewer both of the things and not really be left with this sort of, like, Bill Murray's character is just punching down the whole time. And then he gets rewarded. He gets rewarded for doing that and over again. You know, he's like, he teaches them how to razzle dazzle. And therefore they get rewarded with this like amazing assignment. And it's frustrating because he's just being an asshole. And Asshole in the Army is not a movie, a context I want to see asshole in.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it's the kind of movie that watching it, when you think about him being like, white guys can't tell a joke anymore. And like, nobody like wants like a white guy's opinion. And you watch this movie, you're like, fucking yeah, we had it for years, like for so long. Like it was just assumed this was the only kind of comedy that could exist. Like, yeah, your time is over. And I love and admire many white men, but it made me want all of them to stop making comedies because this was so lazy and so like reliant on the sense of being like, well, you're a funny white guy making a joke. You deserve to have a whole movie about you. And Bill Murray's a massive talent, but it made me like
he doesn't change, really. I mean, he shakes the shards of his hand at the end after being punched in the stomach by him. But it's really, I would rather they have written a movie. Like, at no point do I think, does this movie feel like a conscious effort from these people who are all very funny. It feels like them all trying to be very funny in the same vicinity as each other. And then the movie cuts back and forth to those things and like sort of pastes over the rest with really generic wide shots of guys falling and hitting their nuts or Czechoslovakians ducking from gunfire and like those sorts of things. There's one point where Bill Murray blows the door open by like throwing a grenade and we watch it like explode and then we don't wait for the smoke to clear for the door open. And I'm like, what even was that shot about? Like, just let him run in the thing. We've already seen a bunch of stuff explode.
Did you notice the part in Czechoslovakia where the sergeant, I think, is on top of the van and he screams, I'm getting too old for this shit?
Yes.
That was so weird. I had no, I mean, and I looked up, I was like, oh yeah, Lethal Weapon came out 7 years after this. That was bizarre.
Well, now we know Shane Black just really loved Stripes, probably. And you know what? That kind of tracks.
Yeah. And like, that doesn't make me, like, a whole generation of people was raised loving Stripes, and I can't, like, I don't want to be the, like, young person being like, oh, you guys and your old retrograde ideas. Like, when people watch legitimately great old movies that and feel that way, I find it really obnoxious. And, like, The Philadelphia Story also has really retrograde gender ideas, but it has a million other things to recommend it. It's something about the arrogance of Stripes where it's like, well, this is, we're the kings of the universe and this is how it's always going to be. And it just runs with that as like the kind of its reason for being that rubbed me so much the wrong way.
If I were to think about like memorable moments from this movie, none of them would be jokes, which I feel is the downside of like comedies. Like even like Animal House, you know, you think of like some jokes or I've never seen Porky's, but maybe if you see Porky's, you think of some jokes.
Yeah.
This one I think of like them doing the razzle dazzle bit because, hey, it's like a huge choreographed thing.
Yeah, and well choreographed.
Yeah, and like the getaway of like they're getting out of Czechoslovakia and the thing. And like that's an action sequence. None of the jokes and Stripes really land with me. Actually, him saying we're the American soldier, we're 10-1 was kind of funny. But only because that record would be also be different.
It also came out like, you know, 4 years after Vietnam ended.
Yeah, close enough that that was a funny joke, I guess. But it's not going to be like that's Stripes, you know? Bill Murray made that one joke in his big speech. Yeah.
Well, and like, you know, Ivan Reitman, I guess they all go on to make Ghostbusters right after this. I was like, oh God, is Ghostbusters also bad? Like, am I not going to like it? And then I think like, there's nothing on the line of Ray when someone asks you if you're God, you say yes. Like, there's like nothing even close to that, which is even the best joke in Ghostbusters.
Yeah, and then also none of the two Ghostbusters characters are punching down. There is the Bill Murray hyper-aggressive flirting tactic also gets softened for Ghostbusters. Like here when he's like poking the MP with the stuff and throwing her around the kitchen, I'm like, just let her get away. Yes, I'm like, let her get away. Please, God, Bill Murray. That's
true. Well, and I also thought about that and thought about Groundhog Day, which I haven't seen in a long time. I am assuming safely that it holds up, which is directed by Harold Ramis, and is so much better about, again, the Bill Murray character not punching down, kind of getting what he deserves, like seeing that there is more to life than being a smarmy, clever white guy. And it just, I mean, I guess maybe they had to make Stripes to get to that point where they could make Groundhog Day. So I'm grateful for that. I'm glad that they learned something.
Yeah, I think that maybe it was making this and launching Bill Murray into stardom where, you know, suddenly someone who knew character watched this and was like, oh, no, you can't let him just be the asshole.
Yeah.
He has to be the Venkman. He has to be Scrooge. He has to be, you know, someone who's learning a lesson about being an asshole.
He has to have a Harold Ramis there as like the balancing, like mostly menschy normal person to make all of his stuff work.
Yeah.
So you were reading the SNL book Live from New York that kind of inspired picking this too. What was his SNL persona?
What was his SNL persona?
Did he have one?
So he came in season two. Oh, like what did he represent on the show?
Yeah, I mean, like, I know he was the replacement guy, but like, did the whole like aggressive flirting Bill Murray that we know emerge on SNL, or is that something that only came from like Meatballs and Stripes?
I think it came from Meatballs and Stripes because I think he was more like the. If Belushi was the huge energy guy and Aykroyd was like the middle of the road, Bill Murray was good, but it never looked like he was exerting like all of his energy.
Well, I guess that also continued throughout his career.
Yeah, but I don't know. Maybe the aggressive flirting thing came along with it. I don't know. I haven't gone back and revisited season two of SNL in a while, but it's interesting because as his career goes on, he does, you know, sort of figure it out, I think. That's stuff like Groundhog Day, stuff like Lost in Translation, stuff that's like directly dealing with Bill Murray gets in a relationship is much better than Bill Murray waltzes through a movie that he has no purpose of being in, but is the star of, which is what Stripes is.
Yeah. Well, and even Ghostbusters, it's like he's going with that. And then he's kind of like faced with, you know, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man and all kinds of other crazy shit that's beyond him. So like a legitimate challenge to him. I'm looking at his 80s and he was in Tootsie, which I didn't know. And then Ghostbusters, and he's like the dentist in Little Shop of Horrors, and then Scrooge. Like, you know, he had obviously a great 80s. But it really feels like it does get up to Groundhog Day that he kind of learns to play off of that in some way. And also, Groundhog Day is just a great movie. So,
well, I remember the turn definitely happened in a lifetime. So, what was it? Broken Flowers, where it was like, oh, Bill Murray's going to be quiet and depressed now.
I think Lost in Translation came before, well, Royal Tenenbaums too, which he's great.
Oh, yeah. Royal Tenenbaums.
So, he's like, Royal Tenenbaums is 01, Lost in Translation is 03, Life Aquatic is 04, then Broken Flowers is 05. So, by then, right. I think you're solidly into like Sad Clown Bill Murray.
Yeah. That was the one I remember watching it and being like, this is Bill Murray's a different person to me now.
Yeah. Man, he hasn't done much lately. I'm realizing.
Well, he's coming back for our Ghostbusters. He's
coming back for our Ghostbusters.
He made Bresnikan wear the proton pack.
He sure did. I mean, I don't know. I feel like we're maybe in the same place on the level of excitement for Ghostbusters, which is like, I dare you to charm me with this movie.
Yeah, that's Don't Make Stripes.
Don't Make Stripes. After I finished watching Stripes, I put on My Best Friend's Wedding on Hulu. Like, I basically like scanned through all my streaming services being like, what is an easy comedy that has women in it and that doesn't feel like Stripes? And I settled on, I watched like 30 minutes of that movie, which is deranged, but also great. And was a good palate cleanser, which I recommend.
See, I did Stripes first, which was
actually, Bling Ring.
Yeah, which is actually great.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
Because they're both about white people who make horrible decisions because they're white and they can. But one's a good movie and the other one exists.
Yeah. You know, I've never seen a Cheech and Chong movie. Should that be my next assignment? I'm obviously aware of Cheech and Chong and I've seen like bits of their work, but I've never seen an entire movie.
I would say watch a Cheech and Chong movie. Just the first one you come across. They're going to be similar jokes either way, but
kind of the same.
Just so you know what people are talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I am familiar with them and their existence, but yeah, maybe I owe them the honor of watching Up in Smoke or something. I mean, I've seen Harold and Kumar movies, so it feels like I should see the precursors.
I think it was like my dad had that album with he had like a Cheech and Chong album, so I remember having album introductions to them before they were the movie star people. Well, and before I'm sure my dad was willing to show me a pot movie.
That's hopefully a pop culture literacy I could have stood to have for my parents, but they They introduced me to other stuff, not comedies of the 80s, which is why I'd never seen Stripes.
Well, and now we have, and now we know. Maybe you don't have to see Stripes.
I would love for people to recommend if there are other old movies. And by old, I'm saying pre-1990. Like, I'm going to go with Netflix's terms. Give me what other good old quote-unquote movies are on Netflix that we or anyone else should familiarize ourselves with.
Yeah, and I'll be on YouTube and Canopy for the other things.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to ask in the beginning, how were those Howard Hawks movies? Not Howard Hawks.
Howard Hughes. Hell's Angels is actually still, I think is more enjoyable, if you know the whole story about the making of Hell's Angels.
Is that the one that he crashed the plane for?
Yes, that's the one he crashed the plane for. It's also, one of the biggest, Hollywood premieres ever, because he didn't know if it'd be good, but he knew that they would write about the premiere more than write about the movie. But the movie's actually has, it has a female villain who's very charming, and then some pretty amazing aerial sequences considering when it was shot. But yeah, a lot of, and then also the book Seduction is a lot about, the women in Howard Hughes' lives. So later on, his movie, The Outlaw, I think, I wouldn't say that movie's overall enjoyable, because I think it's bad, but it was fun to watch the first 40 minutes of The Outlaw, knowing the story of The Outlaw and realizing that it was basically a movie to focus on one woman's breasts. And you're watching it, and you're I get it. And he has this really weird shot where she basically French kisses the camera and it doesn't cut away. And it's just you'd think so, but I watched it and I'm I'm almost positive this popped back up in the 70s. So I had no idea it was a Howard Hughes fetishistic thing that rolled in the cinema.
Well, I said Howard Hawks. His Girl Friday is also on YouTube. So you can watch a Howard Hawks movie. That's great. In addition to Howard Hughes movies, which are expensive.
Yeah, they are.
And interesting. God, there's a lot of classic movies on YouTube. You're really right.
YouTube's got, if you got that premium, you don't even get commercials on it.
What year are we up to for copyrights, if you're not Disney?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Because a lot of these movies are from the 30s. 70 years. Oh, no, hang on. Google is not really, it's not really helping me here. But I guess movies from the 30s are now eligible. That's more than 70 years.
Yeah. No, 70 years would put us, in the 50s? Or late 40s?
Oh my god, no, in the 50s now, 1950.
Oh man, we're about to we're about to have a whole bunch of songs that we used to think were oldies be applied to horror movies. Because that horror movie trope where it's an old-timey song but you're seeing something horrible over it? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what that's going to be like when all of the 50s? The yes, oh my god. It's just going to be gore to Mr. Sandman for the rest of my life.
I'm still not really over Happy Birthday being in the public domain now, so I'm trusting.
Me neither. I was watching an episode of Teen Mom today and they showed the two whole stanzas from the Happy Birthday song. I was about to be how did legal let this happen? But I'm no. Oh, yeah, no, that changed as I was working on this exact same show.
Yeah, it changed 2 or 3 years ago.
Katie.
This was fun. I like having movie assignments. The idea, people I know who do podcasts where they talk about a different movie every week, I'm like, oh god, who has the time? But having even a low-key assignment of a chance to watch something is a good way to do it, I think.
Yeah, and we picked reasonably timed movies. I think Stripes is 1:45 and yours is an hour and a half. So
it's definitely part of it. Well, because I had watched, I mentioned in the beginning, The Edge of Democracy, which is on Netflix and is great. Have you heard of this movie at all? It's one of the Oscar documentary nominees.
No, I haven't.
It's made by this woman who is our age, roughly, who is Brazilian, and her parents were radical leftists in the 60s and 70s. And this leftist government kind of emerged in Brazil in the early 2000s, and then slowly, through really complex series of corruption investigations, and then also a rising right wing, which we are a little bit familiar with, and then an impeachment process, and one former president was put in jail, and now they have Bolsonaro, the Brazilian president, who you've probably heard of, who's the one who's burned down the rainforest, and I love Donald Trump. And it just kind of shows you how they got there in this very like methodical and like, it, I mean, it's one-sided. Like she is on the side of the leftist. She is like heartbroken to watch this, this process happen. So if you're going to be sympathetic to her already, it might be an easier watch. But it's also got this beautiful photography of all the Brazilian government buildings, which were built in the 50s and 60s by this modernist architect. They're gorgeous. Look them up. Look up the Brazilian presidential palace and have your mind blown. Anyway, it's like a not easy watch at all, like The Bling Ring, but it's on Netflix, as are a lot of Oscar nominees that are worth watching.
Yeah, and I did all of The Witcher, which is also on Netflix.
Can you sing Toss a Coin to Your Witcher for me? I have keep seeing people mention
Toss a coin to your Witcher, oh Valley of Plenty, oh Valley of Plenty. There are other verses, but that's the chorus.
I'm not that familiar with the Ariana Grande song Break Up With Your Boyfriend, but I know it enough to think it's Toss a Coin to Your Witcher, because I'm tuned to that song and it works.
I want the Katie Rich Witcher Toss a Coin Richard remix after you've watched it.
No, I haven't watched a minute of The Witcher. This is part of the appeal. Right.
So that after you catch up with it, you have to, I think, Toss a Coin's in episode 2 or 3, so you don't even have to do the whole season. Once you get to Toss a Coin, I want you to do the Ariana Grande version, okay. And it'll be fantastic.
Okay. Maybe that'll be on next week's episode.
Possibly.
Should we wrap it up? We did a solid length episode about two movies. Good for us.
Yeah. Two movies. No fighting in the war room this week.
Nope. Just the Cold War fought by Bill Murray and Harold Ramis, as we all remember. Well, next week, David and Patches will be back from Sundance with lots of movies to talk about that we haven't seen, but that's never stopped us before. In the meantime, find us on Twitter at FITWR. Tell us about what movies we should watch on Netflix. I don't know. Find you, Dave. Where are you?
I'm on Twitter at DA70 and on The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast.
And I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, and I'm at Vanity Fair on the Little Gold Men podcast, where this week we're talking about all the Oscar nominated shorts, actually, which are really depressing.
Ooh.
It's not as bad as last year, where like 4 of the 5 live action shorts were about children in like grave peril.
Oh, God, murdered. Yeah.
It's not that bad, but it's still not great. So you can hear us talk about that. The shorts are on iTunes, I believe, and will be in theaters, so you will have access to them. And they're always worth seeing, even if they're kind of grim. So hear more about that.
I'll pitch a short to you right now that I want you to green light right now.
Okay.
Cheech and Chong join the army.
You know what? 14 minutes, I'm in.
Yes.
I feel like at 14 minutes, you could really nail that.
Yeah, they'll do basic training. They'll go to Czechoslovakia. It'll all be there. It'll be 14
and
minutes
they'll
long.
Be in a Winnebago.
Yep.
I guess I can't remember how I wrap up the show anymore. We'll be back talking to you next week.
I'm done. We're done.